Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Today, it's the politics and evils of salt, sugar, and fat.
We're up against a very smart, cunning, if you will, formulation and marketing machinery of the process industry, and it's not a fair fight.
This is Michael Moss, author of Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us.
Salt, sugar, fat, to them, is the holy grail.
And that trio has a past, several thousand years worth. They were power foods, salt preserved foods, so controlling it was everything. There were salt taxes, salt currency, sugar. Everybody wanted it, and only the rich could have it. And fat? People were fat poor. They sold their oil and lard to survive. Fried foods were the be-all and end-all. Stay with us. There's lots more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Culinary mind freeze stalks us all. One day you realize that for weeks you have had the same takeout salad and the same dressing for lunch and the same boneless, skinless chicken breast with balsamic vinegar for supper. You're in a food rut. I know. I've been there. But I'll bet Ted Allen never has. He's in the cook's catbird seat. Ted is the host of Chopped on the Food Network, so he has a parade of new ideas marching past him every single day. Ted, welcome. Good to have you back.
Thank you, Lynn. It's great to be back.
Okay, so you've got all those chefs on Chopped who are inspiring you, but a lot of us get in a rut. So what are some of the ways to get out of that rut?
Well, I think that's a common problem. And, you know, every night I turn to my partner, Barry, and I say, hey, what do you want for dinner? And, of course, he never has any ideas. No, I don't think anyone does when you put them on the spot. So we all have to find inspiration somewhere. And, you know, sometimes for me, it can be a tool in the kitchen. I can spy my melon baller and think, oh, yeah, let's do something with melon. But you're right. The search for inspiration is a big part of the problem of the home cook.
Well, you know, okay, so the idea of going and finding inspiration, where are some of the specific places you like to go? Like, for instance, what are some of your favorite sites?
There are so many. I love a blog by my friend Liza Schoenfein called Life, Death, and Dinner. Liza is a home cook, but she used to be an editor at Saveur. She's been in the food world forever. It's very personal, and she does the photography herself, and she tells stories about her family, her sons, and her husband. And, I love Serious Eats. I love Food 52. I love Grub Street, which is New York Magazine's website.
Right.
For a little gossip, I go to eater.com and pray that I'm not in it. And I have a challenge that I want to throw down, if I may, which is, okay, you're in a rut. You're cooking the same chicken breast every day. You're tired of broccoli. One thing that I like to do is go to the grocery store or maybe go to a different store, particularly an ethnic market. And I especially love Asian markets because you go. It's like I like to look for things I've never seen before. And when you grow up in Indiana and you go to an Asian market in New York City, you're going to see things that you don't know what they are.
Exactly.
Here's a challenge. Pick a vegetable that you think you hate or that you do hate and try to conquer it. And I did that with beets. I like the taste of red beets, but I find the color a little bit off-putting. And then I discovered golden beets. If you can find golden beets, I think you've overcome the thing that so many children and even adults find off-putting about that wonderful, sweet vegetable. And then do something different to them. You know, pickle them, roast them. Sunset Magazine gave me a recipe for roasting beets in a salt crust. So you leave the skin on and you mix egg whites together with kosher salt, and you pack that around the beets, and it sort of just entombs the beets inside this crust, and they just roast in their own juices, and it's a fabulous thing.
There's something else. You say you look at restaurant menus online for ideas, and I had never thought of that.
You know, I have the privilege of talking about food all day with people like Alex Guarnaschelli and Scott Conant and Amanda Freitag, our judges on Chopped. Their lives are about innovating in food, and they have to have people say there are no new ideas, but newish ideas for ways to dazzle their customers. And I remember I was looking at the menu for the restaurant Prune in New York City, Gabrielle Hamilton,
right.
Wonderful restaurant. She had a menu item. It was a sandwich with fried chicken livers on it. And something, I want to say it was bananas or there was something else interesting on it and mustard. And I thought, that is something I've never seen. And I began to think, when you're in a rut, where better to turn than the people who are innovating this way? I had a barbecue for Chopped judges at my house, which is a brilliant thing to do because when you invite chefs over, they come with food in enormous quantities, usually. And one of our other judges, Jeffrey Zakarian, who's a wonderful chef, Jeffrey came over with a salad that is just mind-blowing to me. This was at the peak of summer, so we can't make it yet. It was white peaches, heirloom tomatoes, topped with this luxurious Italian soft cheese called stracciatella, which is like a very soft burrata cheese that has cream added to it,
right.
So it's impossibly decadent, drizzled with a balsamic vinegar. And to think, okay, peaches and tomatoes, they're both sweet, they're both juicy, they're strikingly more similar than you might think in their flavor profile, and they go together in a way that's wonderful. So I came up with a bruschetta recipe that marries tomatoes and strawberries.
Ooh.
And I love to serve it to people without telling them what's coming because you taste it and it's familiar, but it's unusual. And it's surprising. And I love little surprises like that in food.
Great idea. Let's talk the workhorse, the boneless chicken breast. What do you do to give it a little bit of variety? Because it can be very boring.
It can. We all eat boneless, skinless chicken breasts. The good thing about them is that they're a canvas for all kinds of flavor. And there's a recipe in my new cookbook that I can't claim to have authored it. It's a pretty familiar idea to people who are chefs. But to a home cook, maybe you haven't done this. So the first step, and I'm talking about pan frying a chicken breast.
Right.
I always pound my chicken breasts to an even thickness. So I put them under wax paper and pound them until they're a uniform thickness. I cut them to make sure they're all the same size, salt them, pepper them, and wrap them in a piece of prosciutto, which is that wonderful, super thin sliced Italian cured ham. It's salty. It's just packed with concentrated flavor from having been dried and cured. If you like, you could dress this up by placing a couple of sage leaves on the chicken breast and then wrap prosciutto around it. And then you just heat up a pan to medium high, splash a little olive oil in there, cook that thing 5 minutes aside, and you're done. And, you know, it even looks pretty on a plate. You could serve that for a date and still only pay, you know, about $5 for your ingredients for two people. Not too bad.
Not too bad at all. So, Ted, you're going to be on a desert island. What is the one thing you would take with you?
I get that question now and then. Sometimes people ask me, what if you were in prison and you had your last meal, what would it be? The thing about that prison meal is that you're not going to be able to get champagne with it. So that's a real problem for me. You and I are so lucky to work in the world of food. My favorite thing about it is the limitless variety. You could spend 20,000 lifetimes trying to taste everything, and you're not going to be able to, but it's really fun to try. So I suppose if I were stuck on a desert island, I'd like to have some D'Artagnan duck breasts, but then I need a pan to cook them in. Do I get equipment too? Can I have olive oil? I don't like this scenario one bit. How about if I get trapped in Lyon, France for the rest of my life? How about that?
Ted, yes, if we can arrange it, you will be marooned in Lyon.
Thank you very much. And if that's not available, I'll take Florence.
All right. Okay. Ted, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn. Great to be with you.
Ted Allen hosts Chopped on the Food Network. His latest book is In My Kitchen, 100 Recipes and Discoveries for Passionate Cooks. Try his grilled chili lime shrimp with Israeli couscous, mango, and zucchini. And remember, anything you can do with shrimp, you can usually do with other fish, and even that, boneless, skinless chicken breast. Find the recipe on the website, splendidtable.org. You may have heard the term natural wine bandied around your wine shop. Well, natural wine is a controversial category. It's set off disagreements all over the world. For instance, there are winemakers who insist on using natural ambient yeasts, others who insist on banning the use of stabilizers that keep wines from spoiling, and still others who insist on letting nature take its course in the vineyard. Well, however defined, it's a category gaining increased attention. Wine writer Alice Fearing has been tracking the natural wine movement in her newsletter, The Fearing Line, the Real Wine Newsletter. New York Times columnist Melissa Clark sat down to talk with her.
Hi, Alice. Great to have you here.
Great to be here, Melissa.
So define what a natural wine is. Aren't all wines natural?
Well, natural wine is, to be utterly simplistic about it, is nothing added, nothing taken away, except maybe a little bit of sulfur, and it really is the way wine used to be made for centuries and centuries.
And what's the controversy with natural wines? So many people are vocally against them. They have so many critics, but then they have devotees, especially in France.
Especially in France, especially in the UK, especially in the United States now. The problem seems to be mostly with the critics. The drinkers seem to have absolutely no problem about them, and they're just embracing them. But the critiques, the people that sling the mud, will say that they are fuzzy, they are fizzy, they are brown, they are cloudy, and sometimes they taste of apple cider vinegar.
And what do you think?
Well, I've had one or two that tasted that way, and guess what? Those weren't the good ones.
And so for people who love them, what is it about natural wines that makes them so devoted?
Usually it's the excitement. It is that the element to surprise. One of the best examples that I have was I was at a party when Frank Bruni just came over to the States to take over the dining critic of the New York Times. And I said, hey, Frank, taste this. And he burst into laughter. He just started laughing. He said, Alice, what the hell is that? That was the most beautiful example that I ever had. And he went out and bought a case the next day. A conventional wine never can do that to you.
So natural wines just take you just farther to the limit of winemaking.
It's an adventure.
It's an adventure.
It's an adventure.
And also they speak of the place, don't they?
Yes, that is probably at the very heart and soul. Since they're not using a lot of chemical additive, they're not using chemical additive, and they're not using process to change the way the wine tastes, and they're usually from extremely good agriculture, it really is about expressing that place.
Okay, so you just talked about additives. What do you mean by additives? What kinds of things are they putting in other types of wine that aren't natural?
Well, in this country, there are about 200 approved additives. Not all of them are horrible, but a lot of them really just change the way a wine is going to taste and is made. And some of them you might have allergic reactions to. They are, I call them sort of the shape and texture changing.
And like what kinds of things?
Yeast, enzymes, bacteria, added tannins from oak, chestnut, and grape. Gelatin, gum arabic.
Gelatin, is that for texture?
Gelatin for texture, so is gum arabic. Oak chips, oak sawdust, and
sawdust.
Things like that. Yeah.
And what's that for? That's just for the aroma.
It's like tea bags, sort of like soaked. Instead of using a barrel,
an oak barrel to
ferment in, they use oak dust or chips for flavor.
Ah, I see. You'd mentioned wines that are grown in a really careful way, and I think people get really confused about organic wines, biodynamic wines, and then natural wines. What's the difference between them?
Oh, and well, they should be confused because it is confusing. There are different laws in this country than in the EU, which has a new one. But organic and biodynamic really refer primarily to the agriculture. Now, in this country, we've taken it a step further. Organic is do no harm to the vineyard, but you also can use yeast and enzymes and additives as long as they are organic. However, in this country, no sulfur allowed.
Okay.
In the EU, yes.
And what about biodynamic?
Biodynamic is that kind of farming is like homeopathic agriculture. And so it is healing the earth. And there are more laws about how you can make that wine.
Mm-hmm.
Natural wine, it's more philosophy to be, who says, Jessica Grosvenor said, to make a natural wine, you must be a natural person. There's no faking it.
So natural winemaking is just the technique, not the growing.
Right. And within that, you have parameters. You have some parameters with the grape and what you're going to ferment in.
So, Alice, how do I know if I'm getting a natural wine? Where do I find them?
Oh, that's really difficult. You're not going to find anything on the label. If you look over on the back label, you might get some clues. Some people are actually saying this wine is not made with any yeast enzyme additive. It's just grapes. That's a good sign. And go to a respectable wine cellar who knows about these natural wines. They can help guide you to them.
And what about some good ones? What are your picks?
Well, the United States is starting to make some good ones finally, and one of my favorite wine producers is Hank Beckmeyer, and his wine label is La Clarine Farm. That wine will cost you about $22 to $26. If you go to France, go to the Loire Valley in France, one of my favorite winemakers there is Thierry Pouzelat, and his wines will be between $12 and $30.
And his wines are pretty available?
And they're pretty available around the country. If you can't find them, go to Wine Searcher, punch in the name, and they will lead you to a wine store in your neighborhood.
Oh, that's a great tip.
Yeah.
Alice, thank you.
Thank you.
Alice Fearing is the creator of The Fearing Line, the real wine newsletter. Melissa Clark is author of Cook This Now. Coming up, an investigative reporter learns about the much maligned food industry's very own Catch-22. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. In 1999, Minneapolis was the site of a top-secret meeting. The people attending would normally not choose to be in the same room. They were the CEOs of major food companies, the likes of Kraft, General Mills, Cargill, Nestle, Nabisco, Procter & Gamble, Coca-Cola, Mars, and Kellogg. They'd been called together because America was getting fatter faster than ever. A crisis was looming, and blame could end up on the foods they manufactured. This is how Michael Moss opens his book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. He's a New York Times investigative reporter who already has a Pulitzer on his shelf for his work on the meat industry. Now he looks at the industrial science behind creating the irresistible. Michael, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So all of these CEOs in this room, being told what was evolving at that point, a health crisis of obesity in the United States, how did they react?
One of the remarkable things about that meeting was that it was none other than one of their own who got up to give them this bad news. He was armed with 114 slides laying responsibility for the obesity crisis at their feet and urging, pleading with them really to collectively do the right thing. From his perspective, the meeting was an utter failure. The CEOs acted defensively. They argued that, look, we're already conscious of nutrition as we are convenience and low prices. We offer people choices. We have low fat this, low sugar that. And most of all, our food has to taste good. And they left the meeting and they basically went back to what they do. These companies, and look, I don't view them as evil empires that intentionally set out to make this country obese or otherwise ill. The problem lies in their collective zeal to do what companies do, which is make more money by selling more products. And if those products can be healthier, they will do that. They have nothing against that. And yes, over time, though, what's tended to happen is that companies will put out what they call line extensions, a healthier version of their mainline product. The issue that Michael Mudd, the executive from Kraft, was urging them to look at was the mainline products and the overall amounts of salt, sugar, fat, calories, allure that was going into the products that sell the most. And that was the issue in 1999.
I see. Because these companies are making money. That's what a company does. But the responsibility for deciding what's healthy for us or what isn't, that's in the hands of the consumer, right?
You're absolutely right. But you have to remember, walking into the grocery store, the playing field is anything but level. The companies are doing everything they can to make you make a spontaneous decision. That's why you see soda coolers at the checkout counter. Mm-hmm. So, yes, we have some responsibility, but we're up against a very smart, cunning, if you will, formulation and marketing machinery of the process industry. And it's not a fair fight.
Mm-hmm.
Salt, sugar, fat to them is the holy grail. And they know that when they hit those amounts perfectly, they will send us over the moon. I spent time with a legend in the industry, Howard Moskowitz, who walked me through his creation of a recent soda for Dr. Pepper. He actually helped coin the term the bliss point, which is the perfect amount of sugar in any food that will appeal to us the most to get to the perfect soda flavor that would be a hit. He had to concoct 61 different flavors of sweetness, each slightly different, submitted in the 3,000 consumer taste test, threw the data in his computer, did his high math thing, and to come up with the very perfect one. But the point is, and one of the issues here is not that soda is sweet, but that so many products in the grocery store are now sweet that didn't used to be. And as one food industry scientist said to me, you know, the companies are exploiting the biology of the child, especially children are hardwired for sugar. And so now you see breads that are sweet. Pasta sauces are sweet. Low-fat yogurt can have as much sugar per serving as ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
One of the smartest nutrition policy people I know is Mary Nessel at New York University. She said to me that she thinks one of the driving forces here was none other than Silicon Valley. In the early 80s, tech stocks became so hugely popular with Wall Street that Wall Street in turn, you know, looked to the blue chips, looked to the food industry, said, hey guys, you're lagging here. What can you do? What can you do for us? That's when food companies became much more attuned and under pressure on profits. And it's a really important point moving forward here, because even when these companies do the right thing, Campbell Soup has done it, trying to reduce salt in its soups.
Mm-hmm.
Kraft has done an amazing series of things to try to reduce the nutrient loads in its products. Wall Street is there breathing down its neck, making sure that the companies understand that profits come first. These companies, in many ways, are more hooked on salt, sugar, and fat than we are. And they are between a rock and a hard place because they're not just in there to make the foods tasty. They're there acting as preservatives so the food can stay on the shelves for weeks or months at a time.
Right.
And they're there to avoid the use of more costly ingredients like fresh herbs and spices. Salt especially is a miracle ingredient to these companies. It also masks some of the off flavors that will get into food processing. So they're finding that they can dial – they've been adding so much salt, sugar, fat to their products that, yes, they can dial back by 10-15%. But when they start going deeper to really make some meaningful changes in the nutritional profile, they're finding that they drop off a cliff, both in technical terms and in taste.
Michael, how has writing this book changed the way you eat?
I have two boys, 8 and 13, who are walking bliss points for sugar. And my wife and I, are basically trying to engage them in a discussion about nutrition so that, mm-hmm. that they'll really want to do this. And there's kind of a cool example happened the other day. My wife said, look, guys, why don't we try to limit our cereal to those brands with 5 grams or less per serving? And now when we go in the store shopping with the boys, they will pull the boxes off the shelf, look at the fine print, you know, do the math. And interesting, I find that when you engage them in the discussion, they're more apt to like those lower sugar cereals. They're part of the discussion, and kids are smart. And also challenge this notion of convenience, which I think is overhyped. And I think there are any number of products around the grocery store that we actually really don't need to be dependent on.
Michael, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Moss is author of Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Mom's cooking, in the best of all possible worlds, is a gift of love to a child. In Ann Taylor Pittman's childhood world, mom's cooking meant love, but separation too. Anne's the daughter of a Korean woman who married an American GI in 1967, a Mississippi farmer's son. Like a lot of children of newcomers to America, identities became confused, especially when you didn't look like anyone in your school. Anne grew up Southern, not Korean. It wasn't until she was 43, a mom herself, and food editor of Cooking Light magazine, that she made a pilgrimage to Korea, that she chronicled in her article, Mississippi Chinese lady goes home to Korea. Producer Sally Swift got the story.
Anne, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Anne, tell me, what was it like being Korean in the 70s in the South?
Being Korean in the South was a little lonely in the 70s. I wasn't quite sure who I was, what I was, what my identity was. I didn't know much about my mother's life. I didn't know what it meant to be Korean. I thought in my head that I looked like my friends, that I was not different from anyone, but I was reminded a lot that that I was different. And so, you know, the question that always came to me from kids, and, you know, and these are not people who meant any ill or anything negative. This was the question I always got was, are you Chinese? And, you know, I would say no, and it usually dropped at that. And there was no real understanding that there was Asian beyond Chinese. And, you know, I'm not trying to say that everyone in the South felt that way, but certainly everyone I came in contact, mm-hmm. contact with, that was sort of their frame of reference.
So how much Korean culture did you have in your house when you were growing up?
We had a little, and it was usually through food. I lived in small towns in the Mississippi Delta, and at that time, my mother could not get ingredients to cook Korean food. So we would go to Memphis about once a month and go to a small Asian market there. So my knowledge of Korea or what it meant to be Korean was through these dishes like bulgogi, which I loved. I always loved. It's thinly shaved meat that's marinated in soy sauce and sugar, and so it's sweet and salty, and you cook it over really high heat, so it's charred, and it's just delicious. And she would cook these noodle dishes, and I always loved those, using these, I always called them glass noodles, these cellophane noodles made from mung beans. Every now and then, our relatives in Korea would send these packages and these little Korean toys, and the one thing that I remember, mainly because we have photographs of them, were these fancy formal Korean clothes. It's called hanbok, and it was this very shiny, very colorful, vibrant, satiny outfits for my brother and me. And we would get dressed up in those every now and then and say, look, we're Korean. And that was sort of all we knew of being Korean. My mother just didn't share much. And I don't think it was that she was trying to shut us out or anything. It was just for her, there was a lot of pain that she left behind. And she had started a new life in the United States and didn't want to dwell on the past.
You write a little bit in the article about how she would cook some dishes, but there were a couple dishes that she would only make for herself.
Right. My father admits to sort of leading the charge against kimchi. he never liked it. As kids, my brother and I didn't. We were terrified of kimchi. It was so strange. The smell was so strong. We were just kind of terrified of it. I since have come to love it, but we wouldn't eat that. And so my mother missed the flavors of home, and she would make soups with tofu and kimchi, and she would eat them by herself. And when I think back on it now as an adult, I think how lonely that must have been for her to have this one sort of lifeline that keeps her connected to her culture, the one thing that she could do at home that we wouldn't participate in with her.
So you, in middle age, picked yourself up and made your first trip to Korea. You went from Seoul to Busan, right, which is where your mother was from?
That's right. I was kind of spurred on by a couple of things. One was this incident that happened. I make it sound so crazy. This incident at my kids' school. I was having lunch with my kids in their elementary school cafeteria, and a kid walked by the table on his way to put up his tray, and he looked over his shoulder, and I thought, oh, okay, he's about to say happy birthday to my kids or something because they're at the birthday table. I have twin boys, and I was there for their birthday. But he didn't say happy birthday. What he said was, hey, Chinese lady. And I was floored, and it was a really strange, I mean, it was like a scene in a movie. I felt like the camera just focused in on me and everything else blurred away, and that I was 7 years old again, and I was in a school cafeteria in Mississippi. It immediately took me back to that feeling. I came back to work, and I was talking about the power that that child had to put me in this place where I felt lonely and misunderstood and where I didn't understand myself. And, you know, I thought, wow, I need to really learn a little bit more about my identity, about who I am, about what it means to be half Korean. And the only way to do that is to go to Korea.
So tell me about the food scene in Korea.
Oh my gosh, it's so fun. It's the food scene in Korea is very social. So a lot of restaurants are not set up to serve one or two people because it's a communal way of eating. A lot of the food is prepared on the table, at the table. So you order soup and they bring out this large communal bowl and the soup boils on the table, or there are grills for the bulgogi and you cook the food right there on the table. If you're not cooking the food on the table, you're at least all digging out of the same dishes. Sometimes you don't even have your own personal plate. You're just kind of chopsticking little bites off the same plates. It's very social. It's also incredibly intimate when you think about sharing a meal in that way. It's kind of powerful. I think it's a powerful way to connect to people. But it's also incredibly fun, very lively, lots of conversation and lots of drinking too.
So you started in Seoul, you wound up in Busan, which is your mother's town. Tell me about what that was like for you when you got there.
Busan was so different from Seoul. Seoul, I compared to Manhattan. It felt very modern, and Busan was a little gritty, less polished city. But the thing that that stood out as such a difference was that in Seoul, no one thought I was Korean. I look very Korean. My father is American, Caucasian, blonde hair, blue eyes. My mother is from Busan, South Korea. I look Korean. I don't look like my father at all. And I thought that in Seoul, people might think I was Korean, but no one did. No one thought I was Korean. I thought people might try to speak to me in Korean. No one did. But in Busan, a lot of people did. And I thought that was really kind of powerful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is where my mother was from. You know, this is her area. And maybe there's a reflection of that in me. And there was just something very powerful that moved me there, mm-hmm. being there. So my brother and I needed to take a small little day trip to a little town called Hapchan, which was about an hour and a half bus ride from Busan. And this was where we were going to meet my mother's brother, so my uncle and his wife. And we go to the bus terminal there in Busan, and we're trying to figure out how to buy our bus tickets. And this tiny woman approaches me. I mean, this tiny, tiny little woman. She starts talking to me rapidly in Korean. And I just sit there and think, oh, look, another Korean's talking to me and thinks that I'm Korean. I'm kind of sort of patting myself on the back. And, I say, I'm sorry, I don't understand. I walk away from her. And two steps into my walking away, something echoes in my head. And I say to my brother, wait, did she just call me Anne? So he's like, I don't know. We turn around and she has a smile on her face. And I'll never forget this. It's a moment just sort of frozen. And I watch her smile sort of fade and her eyes sort of go unfocused. But we turn back and we walk back to her and her face lights up. And she looks at me and she says, Anne. She looks at my brother. She says, Tim. And then she says, in the most perfect English, I am Susie's sister. And so at this point, I think, oh my gosh, you know, this is the woman we had been told going into the trip that she was a little too frail to travel. She lives on an island off the mainland. We were told we wouldn't be able to see her. But here she's come to meet us at the bus terminal. And I was floored, overwhelmed. I was so excited and just kind of started laughing, choking and hugging her very aggressively. and she was very happy. But then I think, you know, oh my gosh, what did she think when we turned away from her? What? I mean, did she think that she had failed, that she wasn't going to connect with us? And it was a very emotional moment. It was amazing. You know, I had never felt Korean before, although I call myself half Korean, and I am half Korean, and I look Korean.
With a Southern accent.
Right, with a very Southern. I'm also incredibly Southern. But I did feel finally like I was Korean.
What did your mom say about you making this trip?
I really wanted my mother to go on this trip, you know, so I decided I was going. My brother said he would meet me there. we asked our mother to go with us. I really thought it would be great. And she's so incredibly wonderful and wise. And what she said was no, she could not go on this trip because this was our discovery to make on our own. And that, yeah, that still kind of floors me.
Anne, thank you for this story.
Thank you so much.
Anne Taylor Pittman is food editor of Cooking Light magazine. Now you can find her recipe for scallion pancakes with Korean dipping sauce on the website, splendidtable.org. And at that very same website, you will find a place to celebrate Mother's and Father's Day. It's Once Upon a Table, Tales of Eating with Mom and Dad. Send us your recipe or story or photos, and we'll send you exclusive menus to celebrate Mother's Day and Father's Day. Now, the lineup for Mother's Day is chopped sugar snap pea salad with fresh cheese and mint, penne pasta with smoked trout, cream, and asparagus, and an irresistible cream-filled meringue topped with fresh berries, a strawberry raspberry pavlova. So head to the website to contribute your story at splendidtable.org. We'll be back and opening the lines for your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
It is time to connect with you. Pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. We have Heidi calling from one of my favorite places on earth, Martha's Vineyard. Heidi, welcome.
Hi there, Lynn. How are you doing today?
I am doing just swell, but you are on the most beautiful island.
We are so lucky to be here.
So tell me, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Well, my husband and I both work full-time jobs, and for years we have tried to have a very prosperous farm, and one thing after another came up. We've had to be very resilient in our choices, and finally one day it struck me that probably the best thing we could produce on our little farm that would benefit our community and kind of lend something to the local food culture that we have is to make sea salt. After all, we are an island.
Oh my goodness, what an incredible idea.
We started doing the research about a year and a half ago. We've been working on permitting. We've been trialing different types of buildings, different methods, and it is going to be a solar sea salt, which means we are using as little petroleum in the, you know, getting the water out of the ocean and to our farm as possible. And we are going to full production this year as Martha's Vineyard sea salt.
That's incredible.
So my question is, salt is one of my favorite things, and so is wine. And I'm wondering if I could bend your ear and find out what wines you think would be most appropriate with our finished salts. That is going to be our coarse salt. That is just the all-natural grain versus maybe a medium grind, something that we actually pound down with between parchment versus a fine salt.
Well, it's, of course, what the salt is on. And generally, I'm just thinking, you know, it's so interesting. People say, what do I pair with chili? What do I, you know, main flavors, predominant flavors. What do I pair with fruit? Never have I been asked about salt. But it makes sense. Okay, there are some very fresh, bright wines. The Vino Verdes of Portugal, for instance. There are similar wines that are done in the United States. These whites that are bright, fresh, acidic, if they have a little fizz to them, all the better, that really are wonderful with salty things. So if you're going to do the large grain, where when you use large grain salt, you really get a lot of impact of salt when you crunch into it. And the sound does things to us. We enjoy the sound of that. Of that crunch. So obviously think in terms of, well, what's the salt going on? If the salt is going on a steak, you're going to probably want something like a Shiraz or a Cabernet, but nothing with a lot of age on it. You want fruit. You want a really fruity kind of wine.
So maybe a Grenache?
A Grenache would be wonderful. That would be super. A Tempranillo would be super. But the point is, if you're going to do it with a white wine, I would go for the Vino Verdes. I would go for very fresh Sauvignon Blancs. I would go for things like very, very dry sparkling wines. They do not have to be champagne. This New Mexican vineyard, Gruet, G-R-U-E-T, does sparkling wines that are great, and they're bright, and they're fresh. So
I love the fact that they're in the U.S.
Exactly. So that's the direction to go. And then
with
the finer grind, then you're talking, well, we're seasoning. And then I think the thing that dominates is you don't want things overly salted. So what would dominate is the salt would be the backup, the platform. So then you look at what is the food.
Now, and what would you consider to be a good host for salt if we were trying to pair something, not necessarily use food as the base, but just a...
As a tasting base? You know, for someone to say, taste our salt with this?
Yes.
I wouldn't host anything. I would have them taste the salt straight.
Okay,
straight up. Straight up. That's how you do olive oil. If you do olive oil, you know, the way the pros do, I would taste salt straight up because when you do, but make sure you've got soda water or, you know, water or whatever so they can cleanse their palates because, boy, does it stay with you.
I couldn't agree with you more. I just put that note on the side there.
Good luck with the business, Heidi, and thanks so much for the call.
You're welcome. Thank you for being on the air.
Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye. You can reach us any way you want. You can send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. You can connect with us on Facebook and Twitter, or you can actually call us, 800-537-5252. And that's what Ariel's done from Chicago. Ariel, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call.
You are welcome.
I had a question about growing herbs indoors. I live in an apartment in Chicago, and I don't have any windowsill plants, and I don't have any, you know, area to garden anywhere, and I would really like to have some fresh herbs anyway. I tried once with rosemary, and it went rather poorly, so I was just hoping you had some advice for me.
Well, I'll tell you one thing I learned the hard way with rosemary, indoors or outdoors, do not overwater it.
Oh.
Yeah, too much goodness for rosemary is not a good thing. It's used to being kind of lean and dry a bit, not super dry, but it's dry, but... I was in the same boat when I had my apartment because there were no windowsills.
Yeah.
You know, but what you can do is get one of those bookshelves. You know those. You know they're you can put them under a window. They can be very attractive. IKEA has a ton of them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and you know something that works with your home, but they're wide on the top. You know they're 12 inches deep. So that's you can tuck that under the window or in a window if you've got one of those floor-to-ceiling numbers and in a place where it gets the most sun. Generally, the southern exposure is best. In an apartment, often you don't have a choice.
Right.
Yeah. But there are grow lights, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. If you go into, you know, any nursery, flower shop, home store, you're going to find grow lights, and they even clip on, and they supply light for the plants. And what you want to do is some of the easiest things to grow are things like thyme and rosemary. The mint family is just, you know, so prolific. But you want to learn a little bit about those plants. For instance, the thyme and the rosemary can get a little bit dry. And anything in that family, so that would be savory and that kind of thing. Whereas the basils, the marjorams, the oreganos, they like a little bit more moisture, and they like a nice, rich soil. So get some potting soil. Get a little bit of powdered lime, okay?
Oh.
Yeah, because that keeps the soil from being too acidic. And because acidic soil is not what herbs like. They like the opposite. So a little bit of lime. It's in a powder. You put it maybe for a pot. You'd put a teaspoon of it into the potting soil.
And just once or?
Once. That's all. You just mix it in. Okay. You know, you get a big mixing bowl. You mix up that soil with that. And then what you do is you plant the herbs and allow about, you know, a lip around so water will be held in on the top of the pot. And make sure, put them on a tray with pebbles so they've got a lot of good drainage. Because you don't want water sitting in the pot. You want water moistening the soil but being able to drain away. So if you put them on a bed of pebbles, and they can be really great-looking pebbles.
Yeah.
Right. And that will give them a little bit of moisture, you know, a little bit of humidity in the air, but it will also help them drain properly because that's another problem. Often we put them in containers or we overwater them or they're sitting just flat on something and there's nowhere for that water to go and the roots rot.
Okay.
So that's the basics right there. And give them lots, as much sun as you possibly can. And then as you go along, you know, as the new growth starts, you can pinch that back and that's what you can season with.
Oh, yeah.
And they'll get bushy and gorgeous. The one thing with basil, because basil is best when it's very young. So if you can stagger your plantings, like, you know, plant a pot or two of basil this week, then in another couple of weeks, plant another pot or two of basil so that you'll always have it when it's young and that's when it's sweetest and luscious and just wonderful.
Oh, now I'm hungry.
So almost any herb. This is going to work with almost any herb.
Okay, great. That sounds pretty doable.
Yeah, it's really basic. And trust me, if I can do it, anybody can do it.
Well, thank you so much.
You are welcome and good luck with the herbs.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye. Anamike connected with us on Facebook, and she wants to know, what kind of cheese can you fry? Well, I'll tell you, the most famous cheese to fry is called halloumi. It's from the Middle East. I think it originated in Greece, and it's a very mild cheese, and it comes in kind of, it's like a patty almost. It's about a half inch to an inch thick, and you just slowly fry it in a skillet. Usually a nonstick one's not a bad idea, and quite frankly, I like to fry it in a little bit of olive oil with black pepper. It is delicious. It gets kind of sticky and gooey when you pull it out. But of course, the other thing you can do is make what's called frico, which are kind of like a cheese crisp or cracker, where you just sprinkle cheese like Parmigiano, grated hard cheese, in a circle, so form a disc, and you put it into a nonstick skillet and let it gently, gently melt, and then you can get underneath it and just flip it out. And it's wonderful. They're like big chips, and you can nibble on them, you can use them to garnish things, and they're really fabulous. So try them both. 800-537-5252 is one way you can reach us. Facebook and Twitter, two other ways. And, of course, there's always email, splendidtable.org. We've got Joel calling from New York. Joel, what do you want to talk about?
I would like to talk about a bottle of watermelon schnapps that we inherited after a party recently.
I like this form of inheritance. What does it taste like? I don't think I've ever had watermelon schnapps.
You know, I tasted it last night, and it actually tastes surprisingly like fresh watermelon. I expected it to taste like candy, and it really kind of tastes like an actual watermelon. So I was a little bit surprised there.
Well, you know, there's a couple of options here. I mean, number one, if it really does taste like fresh watermelon, why not throw that into, you know, it'd be kind of fun to do. I've never done this, but it might be interesting. You got to wait for watermelon season because you got to get some fresh watermelon. But I'm thinking is to do a watermelon jelly. And in our language, that's jello, where, you know, you would essentially puree the watermelon and squeeze out the juice. Okay. And then you would, you know, just put flavorless gelatin in that with some sugar and maybe a little shot of lime or lemon just because that acid brings up the flavor. But also put in the bit of the watermelon schnapps. And then, you know, you could freeze it in goofy kind of forms. And that could go on top of, you know, ice cream, right? You come out with a scoop of vanilla ice cream and then this watermelon jello schnapps teddy bear or something sitting on top of it. It's absolutely goofy. But it could really be great because those things, you know, slowly melt when you put them in your mouth and you'd get all that flavor. It'd be wonderful. The other thing I would do is, are you familiar with the agua frescas that they make in Mexico?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Well, why not finish off one of those? Why not start an agua fresca cocktail this summer where you put those over ice, which is just the puree of melon with, you know, sugar. Same idea as what we just talked about, but without the gelatin.
Mm-hmm.
And then add some watermelon schnapps and then on a skewer have chunks of the watermelon may be studded between leaves of, let's say, something like basil.
because watermelon and basil is a pretty dynamite combination.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be fabulous?
Yeah, that sounds great, actually. Yeah, the basil, I think, is I feel like that might be my missing ingredient. That could really be exciting.
You know, the other thing that would be great in that is just the littlest touch of chili pepper.
Yeah,
you know, because the watermelon would just, it's so lush and fresh, and the chili pepper would give it some spark. So you've got a new cocktail.
I do.
There you go.
Excellent.
Go forth and enjoy watermelon schnapps. So now I'm going to look for it in the wine shop.
Yeah, sounds good. Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Joel. Take care. Bye. Watermelon schnapps. Well, you know, whenever you've got a fruit schnapps or a fruit whatever of alcohol, think of marrying it in some way with the juice. So if you've got, you know, one of the pomegranate liqueurs, some fresh pomegranate juice and some ginger ale, really good ginger ale, on ice, and maybe with a little bit of grapefruit juice, because somehow grapefruit and pomegranate is not a bad idea. You do that on the rocks, stir it with maybe a cucumber stick. Ooh, out of this world. Just fabulous. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for being with us. You have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this from Robin Williams, who said, "Spring is nature's way of saying, let's party." Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now, you can head over to splendidtable.org for information on anything you heard here today. You can look at our latest ebooks, Eating In with Lynn, download our weekly podcasts, rifle through our recipe box, and register for our free weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Laura Kalibi. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Well, we're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.